Amen. Amen. Wow. Love here. Love Enniskillen. We were out a wee driver last night, just seeing different parts of Enniskillen, and to be honest, I wouldn't mind moving here. it's cool. Yeah. my name's Ryan Lennon, for those who might not know me. I was here a little under 2 years ago. I was a broken man. At that point, I was severely withdrawn from heavy drugs, heavy prescription use of drugs, and also a lot of cannabis was through my system at that point. But I just want to start off by thanking John and Charlene and all the guys here for welcoming me and Sarah down to be able to share my testimony. And as I say, this is the first service. I just want to encourage you by saying that this is one of the first services that I had actually ever been to. I have never been to the Causeway Coast Vineyard. I never had been welcomed in the church, and this was the first church I ever stepped my foot in. So I want you to be encouraged by that. And it doesn't matter how big or small the church is, where the Spirit wants to be, the Spirit will be. And just where you guys, I see that. You know, there's a joy being here. I always wanted to come down, but I didn't drive. So it's pretty, it's pretty awesome to be back. And I brought along my wife, Sarah. Sarah Lennon. She's sitting there gorgeous as ever. And and she's going to come up after and share a wee part of her story and what impact Jesus made in her life also. But I want to take you back to my story. I want to take you back to the beginning of Belfast. That's where I'm originally from. I lost the accent. As you can probably tell, I've got a bit of culture accent, a bit of country in there somewhere. So if you don't understand me, I think we have a translator somewhere. No. So anyway, I was born in Belfast. I'm one of nine children. My mum had nine kids, and I'm the third oldest. My bigger brother passed away not that long ago, a couple of years by. Belfast is a pretty different place back in the days, as you probably know. I was probably up till about 6 years of age, I lived in Belfast, and I want to really speak on my father. Who I know very, very little about. I don't know what he sounds like. I'll break into that later on. But anyway, my dad was a very violent man. He was a very, very notorious man of Belfast. He was involved in the UVF, the Shankill, and he was involved in weapons. He hid weapons. He shot people. You're talking rough. He was the man. And through off the back of that, my mum didn't want me growing up among that and stuff. So my mum left my father, and as I say, I have no memories of him. I can't remember his voice. I can't remember what he looked like. I couldn't tell you anything about him. Any memory that I had with him is distant. I couldn't tell you really much. So off that, we moved to a place called... Now, we were living in the Shankill. We were living in different places in Belfast, hostels and many places that were like my mum, women's aid and different things, because my father was pretty violent. And so this is crazy. We moved to Ardoyn, and if you know Shankill and the Ardoyn, it's pretty, it's world apart. So we moved there. My mum met a new partner, and she fell in love with him. She got married with him, and I started calling him daddy and stuff. And from living in the Shankill Road to moving in the Ardoyn, I started receiving bullying in primary school. So people were calling me orange this, they were calling me different things because I was ultimately a Protestant. And I remember being in class, and my stepdad come walking in, and the little kid who was bullying me, he just walked straight up to him and punched him in the face. And I was sitting there, I was like, what? I was 6 years of age watching this happen. So I thought that was the way to deal with things. I thought that was the way to go. And so anyway, there was troubles going on around my home. There was fires going on. There was riots going on. We were getting caught up in like different things. And I remember moving to Ballycastle. My mum wanted to make a fresh start for all the kids, but she wanted to get away from the troubles in Belfast, and also from my father, who was pursuing us. But he ended up getting put out of the country because he was causing that much disruption. He was running about with guns, pointing at people's heads, looking after my mum. He was ready to kill me and my brothers and all that sort of stuff. So my mum moved away, about 60 miles away, to a little town called Ballycastle. And Now, Ballycastle is like a wee town like Enniskillen. Everyone knows each other and everyone gets along. And, well, I hope so anyway. And so we moved there and I ended up going, meeting new friends. I was in primary school and I started making new friends and I had this pure broad Belfast accent. And I don't know where it went. It's in there somewhere. When I hit Antrim in the train, it tends to come out. Sarah makes fun of me sometimes. So, yeah, there I came with a lot of problems. I came with a lot of issues, a lot of anger issues. I was a very, very angry young kid. So I brought it into school. And I remember the headmaster and the teachers kind of had a pick on me. I just thought, why do they not like me? Is it my accent? Is it the way I get on? I just didn't fit in anywhere. And so I knew that as a 7-year-old boy, P1 or P2, I started to get this feeling of not being welcome. So I started rebelling against that and I started going home and things were going on wrong, so, so wrong at home. Like my mum was getting beaten in front of me. I was protecting my mum. I remember my mum's boyfriend chasing her around the table, beating her and beating her. And I was running. I was like, mommy, I was protecting her. And as I jumped on my mum to protect her from being hit, my younger brother, who was probably about 3 or 4, jumped on top of me from being hit. So I was watching that going on home and I was bringing it to school. And like I was not a good lad. I was like, you're talking like I was P5. I was robbing off my teacher. I was stealing her glasses. I was taking lunch money. And for a young kid to be able to get into that sort of thing, there must have been something going wrong. And I thought that was normality. And so through primary school, I was very violent. I was fighting, getting into a load of fights. I was taking the anger and was going through a lot of abuse in my home from people in my family. And I was taking it into school and I was making a habit. So I remember getting into secondary school. This started to progress even more. I started to fight with guys who were double my size. I started to fight with guys who I thought I could take on. To be honest, I thought I could take on the world. And so that kept going on. And I got expelled from the school that I was in. And the teachers just kept like saying, you're a failure, Ryan, you'll never make it, and stuff like that. And I remember going home and just the words kept repeating in my head that I was a failure, that I was a failure. And I took that on, like a 12-year-old boy, that I was a failure. And I remember sitting in my bed just wishing I was dead. I remember sitting contemplating suicide. And that was the first time I ever thought of self-harm. It was the first time I ever thought of hurting myself, because the pain that I was feeling inside, I needed a way of expressing it on the outside. So I started to self-harm at the age of 12. I started becoming addicted to that. Anything that went wrong, that was the first thing I turned to. So it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. I was using different things. I started off with pencils. I started off with different things. And I moved on to sharper objects. Started moving on to different things to get deep, to get really hurt myself. And I don't know why I was doing this. Well, I really do know why I was doing this, because I was hurting inside. I was searching for something, wasn't I? I was searching for something that I didn't know what was there. I was looking for in my mum. My mum wasn't able to do that. My father was absent. The friends that I was running about, I was ruining relationships with them. I couldn't run about with them because their mums didn't want me to run about with them. So like this whole circle around me was just like no one wanted me. It felt like just the world was against me. And so things, my mum fell out with a few people in Ballycastle. I felt comfortable in Ballycastle. I started making friends. I was in hurling and I was doing my Gaelic and I was doing my sports. I was doing your regular teenage boy things. But inside I was feeling all this crazy emotions, this anger, this rage. These emotions that I've never thought that I would manage. So I started like going to like these mental health psychiatrist places, taking medication at the age of 14, being diagnosed with all these crazy things by doctors. And my mum moved to Coleraine to get away from the crap that she was going on. She fell out with friends and my daddy, my stepdad, left again and she left on. And we went to the Women's Aid, and there I met one of my best friends. We started a new school. I started secondary school at about third year. I was about 14 years of age. This would have been about 2007, and I met a boy called Ryan Quinn. Okay, now Ryan was a lad like me. He was funny, He was the class clown. Everyone loved him when he walked in. Everyone's eyes was on him, and everyone wanted a bit of banter with him. We were just too bad. We were too badasses, like, you know what I mean? And we thought we were cool. And so I instantly connected with him, became best friends. And he asked me out one time, and I says, yeah, man. He wanted to come to my house, but I lived in the Women's Aid, and I didn't want to say that where I lived. And so when I remember meeting him, and he goes, can you fight? I says, of course I can fight. I says, I'm a good fighter. And the guy goes, why do you ask that? And he goes, we have a gang, and I want you to be in the gang. And I was like, of course. I says, not a problem. It was something that the fighting was something that was in me. And so we joined this little gang called Heights Hoods, which is Korean. There's a Catholic and there's a Protestant area in Korean, which is complete worlds apart. Now, if you're a Catholic, you're a Celtic supporter, and it wasn't something that was a football-orientated thing. You supported Celtic, and you were a Catholic, and you hated Protestants. That was the end of the story. That was the ins and outs of it. So I started to become a very, very bitter person against the other side of the community. Now, this wasn't something that we were fighting once a week. I mean, we were organizing the fight every single day. This thing was going on a daily basis. Like, I've never got into a fight that I couldn't handle. I remember just going across the bridge. We were going through rivers just to get the guys and stuff. As you know where Korean is, there's a river that splits, and we used to meet at the other end, meet in the end of the at the middle of the bridge and fight. And it started progressing on to where I was bringing it into school. Then the police started calling to my home. And just with these sort of things you're doing in your life, you know, there's consequences come with this thing. And there's a little thing that Korean have, and it's called the UDA. And they started hearing of me and my behaviour, and also my big brother. So I was with my partner at this time. I was in the Diamond Centre in Korean, and I got this phone call from my mum. She was like, Ryan, you need to get home. You need to get home quick. I need you here. And I was like, what's going on now? So I ran home, and I saw two police cars sitting outside my mum's door. And I was just like, someone's dead. I was like, someone's dead. What's happened? And I remember walking in, and the policeman, my mum was just weeping, and she was crying, and she was sobbing her heart out. And I was like, what's wrong, mummy? What's wrong? And then the policeman just looked at me and handed me this letter. So I read the letter, and it was a death threat. I'd received a death threat from the UDA. 72 hours to leave my home, or me and my big brother would be shot dead. I took that in. I laughed. I says, it's a lot of crap. I says, don't listen to it, mommy. You know, but the police were saying, listen, you need to leave. So yeah, we moved back to Ballycastle, and through that, the phone call came that changed my life forever. I was lying in bed one time and playing FIFA, 2000 and whatever, I think it would have been 2009, playing FIFA with my younger cousin. And I got this phone call from a fella who I knew very little about. And he was like, listen, Ryan, I've got something to tell you. And I was like, what is it? He goes, don't take it true. I've only found out this. And he says, Ryan Quinn's dead. And I was just like, oh, don't talk crap. I said, don't call, you know, you couldn't believe any word that any of our people said. You know, our banter was making fun of each other. Our banter was, you know, putting you to the ground. It's like a Northern Ireland thing. You know, you slag someone to have a bit of banter to lift yourself up. And so I was like, listen, don't listen to that crap. And then I got another phone call, and he says, no, it's true. He says, Ryan's dead. Still didn't believe it. I was like, I need to hear from his mum. I need to hear from someone. And my little sister, Lauren, came bursting in the door. She was at a little thing called the Elk, which is like a little party teenagers go to and have a bit of fun. Drink their wee fizzy juice and stuff. And she came home, and she was weeping and she was crying, and I began to realise that Ryan had been murdered. Now, when Ryan died, that night I found out they'd have passed away. You know, it didn't change me to do better for myself. It, like, put me on a path of pure destruction. That's when I started hitting the drugs, and that's when I started really rebelling against people. He was murdered for his religion, his Catholic background and stuff. He was hit by a train in Portrush, We were seeking blood. We were seeking for these guys. We were like, who killed him? And it kind of went on and like went on, and still to this day, nothing's ever came off it and stuff. And, you know, so I still hold that in my heart to this day. I still hurt over that. I still cry, and I still like, I'm like, is he in heaven? Is different things going on? Just these emotions keep going through my head. And so we moved away to get away from it again. So we were talking like moving different places. Like I was going through like abuse at this time. I was going through relationship problems. I was going through drugs. I was going through like alcohol. So you're talking like this 15-year-old fella who's taking drugs, going through a death and different things, like, you know, destruction was happening. Like it wasn't a good situation to be in. And I remember taking my first ecstasy pill. And I ended up me in prison. Just to cut a long story short, I don't want to get into too much details, but these two little fellas, innocent lads, they were probably about double my age. Me and my cousin hammered them, and their fella near died. And I got arrested. I was 15 years of age and got put away in prison. And I spent about 9 months there, about a year in and out, and went to court and stuff like that. I get sentenced and I get let out and different things like that. And from being in prison, it was just a spiral. It was just more. I was out in tag and I was getting involved in drug dealing. I was getting involved in different things, and it was becoming something that I needed to do. I was making a lot of money, and I was feeding off the money. Money was like, I needed money. I was greedy. I started to become something that I really needed to be around. And my mum, when I was in jail, my mum started getting addicted to drugs. My mum started getting addicted to heroin, and she was bringing people into the house. And all my brothers and sisters went into foster care. We were all took away from my mum, and I came out of the jail, and I had nowhere to live. I was homeless at the age of 16, 17. And I remember just always wanting to be there for my mum, crying after, and I wasn't allowed near until I was 18 years of age. Social services wasn't allowed me near my mum. They were saying she's too dangerous for you and all that sort of stuff. So they were setting me up with different places, like different homes, different hostels and all that sort of stuff. And I moved to Coleraine, and I met my partner at that time, and I moved in with her, and I had somewhere to stay. And, you know, I was sofa surfing in different places. I was partying. I was like doing different things just to be, you know, in someone's home for somewhere to stay. And luckily, I was never sleeping on the streets. I always had somewhere to go. I always had somewhere. I always had someone to welcome me into their home. And I thank God for that. He was looking out for me in them darkest times of my life. And I remember I was doing okay. I was making a lot of money. I was selling a load of drugs, and I had the woman and all. I thought we were class. She sold drugs, everything. We were living the life. Money was coming through the door, all that sort of stuff. And I was the bad boy. Everyone feared me. Everyone spoke about me. No one really never knew of me. And so anyway, I remember one time we were living in this place called Harper's Hill, which is down from the Causeway Coast Vineyard. And it's so funny because I drive there every single Sunday. And it just reminds me of this night. I remember on the phone to my brother Mark, and he was like, "Ryan, man, you need to get rid of your stuff. You need to hide it out in the back garden. You need to bury all your stuff and blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "Oh, listen, I'll be all right. I'll be all right." And I remember standing, and I seen out the window, just looked out the window, and there was a man come running up the alley. I had this alleyway across from my house, and he came running up. And next minute, he just balaclava on, no face, balaclava, opens up and starts shooting fire at my home. And he emptied like 5 or 6 bullets into my house. One came in the door, near hit my little brother Marty, who was standing eating a bowl of cereal. And one came up through my bed. Luckily, I wasn't on my bed, neither was my partner. And there I go, I began to laugh again. It was the nerves kicked in. So they tried to take my life. They tried to take me out because of things I was doing. Like I was running about with knives and stuff. Like, I mean, you're talking like crazy stuff. I was not a good person. And a lot of people feared me, but I loved that sort of thing. I loved that. And off the back of that, me and the partner, we moved away because we got shot at and stuff like that there. And we moved to Port Stewart. And I looked out my bedroom window. There was 3 masked men again. And I got out in time. I rang the police and I got out, and I just said I had enough. I had enough of everything. I had enough of running away. I had enough of the paramilitaries trying to take my life, trying to shoot me. There was shootings going on around Coleraine. People were getting kneecapped. There was shotguns being used. You talk about it, and I was top of the list. And so I was mentally exhausted from it all, as you could probably, you know, gather. And I moved to Belfast. I split up with a woman that I was with, and I moved to Belfast, and I got away from it all. But I didn't really. I was still, you know, I had my own mind. I had my own heart. Every time, like, I was trying to sleep, everything was coming through my mind. Even the thing from the past that I was a failure, it was still there. And I was about maybe 20 at this age, at this time, and I was smoking the weed every single day. Like, if I had a choice with a meal or a bong, I'd have took the bong straight away. That was something that I needed. I needed to cope with. It was something that I lent on. It was something that I really needed to get by on my day-to-day basis. You know, there's loads of things that I haven't spoke about in my past, like, but I'll be sharing a wee bit more into the 6:30 one. But I really want to jump straight into when I moved back to Port Stewart. My mum moved to Port Stewart. She had a home. She was just out of Ross Thompson, a mental health institute and stuff, and she got herself a wee home. And I was like, I'm going to go down and visit my ma. I'm going to go down and visit my wee ma. And I went down, and I went down for a party. And ended up going on Facebook and seeing this little blonde girl on my friend, not my friends list. Yeah, I saw you were. And I was like, she looks cool. I was like, I'm going to ask her on a wee date. This girl's called Sarah McKinney. And this time she was Sarah McKinney. So I messaged her and I says, yo, chick. I says, do you want to go out on a wee date? And she was like, oh, yeah, of course. And I says, where do you want to go? And she was like, Kelly's. I says, right, let's go to Kelly's, as you do back in the days, Kelly's type thing. I'm talking about back in the days. This is 2 years ago, guys, okay? What am I on about? Who are you kidding, Ryan? I seen this wee blonde bombshell, and I was like, she's going to be mine. And wrong intentions to begin with. So we went to Kotski, which was last night, actually. They do it every single year. And Kotski was last night in Kelly's. And I wrote up a Facebook post saying I met my wife there. And me and Sarah went, didn't we? And we partied all night. So we did, and we were drinking. And the drinks were flying, and we were raving, and we were taking selfies and videos and all that sort of stuff. So I was like, I'm going to take you home. So me and Sarah went home, and she stayed that night. Then she stayed the next night. Then she stayed the next night. And then I was like thinking, I'm going to get rid of her. Just the frame of mind I was in, I wasn't good. But anyway, I did. I ended up falling in love with Sarah. I started feeling that love for her. I was just like, she's cool. But with Sarah came a lot of problems. Like, I mean, a lot of problems. Which that made me love her 10 times more, because I had a lot of problems and she had a lot of problems, and we could share them problems. Sarah made me focus a wee bit, get me back together in my life, like, type thing. You know, it tended to do that for me. It was a temporary fix. And Sarah took my mind away from it. And at this point, I was still selling the stuff. I was actually shipping kilos of cocaine from Junction 1 to Derry, and bringing it in from China and Dubai and different places like that. And I remember this stuff coming through my door, and it was a parcel of methadrone. Now, it was the old school stuff. This is stuff that wasn't about this country anymore, and it gets sent from Dubai to my door. And I rang the fella and I said, listen, can I take some? And he was like, yeah, you take 3, I'll take 7. I says, no problem. So I took 3. And I got hooked on it, and that was me. I took the entire thing on him. And this is a fella who is pretty scary. Like, he's no paramilitary guy. Like, you're talking like he's above these guys. And the night before I found out that me and Sarah were having Matthew, I was up in his house, and we were sniffing cocaine. He owns a big car company, and we were in the cars, and we were sniffing the coke. And next minute, he puts on these gloves. And I'm sitting there, why is he putting on gloves? It's roasting. And so he walks into the back, and he's gone for a wee while. And I'm with one of my friends, David McCrudden, who's a boxer, and he came back in with this gun. And he looks at me, and I look at him, and I'm like, I'm getting shot here. I was sitting down, and he just put the gun to my leg, and he says, where's my stuff? and I'm only after a line of cocaine here, and my heart is already pounding. And he put the gun to my leg, and he says, "Where's my stuff, Ryan?" And I was like, "Man, I don't have it. I'm sorry." It's like, "I took it." Then he burst out laughing. He goes, "I'm only joking." And I was like, "What are you doing to me?" type thing. And he was like, "Listen, Ryan, you put me back 100 grand worth of money. You put me back worth a month's work and all that sort of stuff." So anyway, I was just like, "This is crazy. I need to get out of here." And it was when Conor McGregor was coming about and stuff, and we were watching his training videos, and he was becoming a big star at that time. And so anyway, I said to him, I was like, "Listen, man, I think Sarah's pregnant." And he goes, "Aye, your life's, that's the end of your life now, Ryan," and all that sort of stuff. And I went home, and I remember Sarah being panicky and stuff about the response that I was going to make to her being pregnant. And she come walking up the stairs, and she looks at me, and the famous words come, "I need to speak to you." And I was like, "Oh, here we go." And then the other ones come, "Sit down." I was like, "Oh, no." So she says, "Ryan, I'm pregnant." And I took a wee hesitation to think about it, and I burst with joy, absolute joy. And I grabbed her, and I was just started screaming, and I was like, "Are you being serious? Are you being serious?" and stuff. And I was just so overwhelmed. And that just kind of made me focus on something different, trying to get my life together. But I didn't know how to do that. I was never introduced to Jesus. I was never introduced to church. Church was a stupid thing to me. Church was silly. Jesus was a curse word. Jesus was nothing to me. But I wore the cross all my life. I wore the crucifix and stuff my whole life. The Catholic side of it, I did that. I did the religious thing. And so anyway, I went to the gym. I says, "I'm going to tone myself up a wee bit," because I was really skinny at this point. I still am, okay? But I wasn't eating. I was smoking a lot of drugs. I was selling a lot of drugs. I was sniffing a lot of drugs. And when Sarah told me she was pregnant, it just kind of flicked. I was just like, right, shook me up a wee bit. I was like, I need to search for something. And so I went to the gym, Energy Gym, and I joined the gym. I was in a lot of debt with the gym, and I just went up and I just said, "Listen, let me pay," and I went in. Very lucky I get in that day, and I went in and I seen these two bald fellas in the corner, and one was called Mark Marks and one was called Scott McNamara. And just around them there was this glow, just around them there was just this presence, and I was like, you know, I mean, them boys look like they're in the DA, but there's something about them that's like different. And so I did. I thought they were dodgy fellas, but there was something that was around them that just didn't make sense. So I was sitting there, I was on the railing, and I was sitting like that, and he came walking over, and he was like, "All right, yeah," and all this wee English accent and stuff. And he started talking about this Jesus. And I was just like, "What's this boy on about? Like, you know what I mean? I'm not into this." Like, I was just like, "He's so stupid. He's preaching to the wrong guy here." And I was just sitting there, taking it in, taking it in. And he was just like, "Listen, I love you," and all that sort of stuff, and then walked away. And so that was all right. I went home, and I said to Sarah, I was like, "There's this guy, Scott McNamara. He was doing my head in the gym." And I probably didn't even really say it like that, but but this Jesus kept coming into my mind, just kept repeating Jesus, Jesus, and Jesus. And I was just like, so it started to make me a wee bit curious. He didn't do the Jesus at the door. He didn't do the miracle question. He didn't do any of that fancy stuff. He just spoke about Jesus. So I just kept hearing these words, just Jesus, Jesus. And it was just like that time I was hearing, "You're a failure, you're a failure, you're a failure." I just kept hearing Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. So I was like, I didn't even find out what this boy's all about. I was like, why is he talking about Jesus in this such intense way? And so when I checked him up on Facebook, and I seen the picture, and he was like that, and he had a hat on and all that stuff that Scott does. And I was so drawn to him. I was just so drawn to what he had, but I didn't know what it was. And so anyway, I messaged him, and I always go back to the first messages me and Scott ever sent each other, like, and you thought we were best friends. I was like, "You're a top lad." He was like, "Oh, you're a legend," and "Yeah, man, you should come along to my group and all and stuff like that, and know what Jesus is all about and stuff." And I was like, "You know, I'm not into that, man, but I appreciate what you're doing for people." Because he done something to me, that's why. He done something in there, but I never knew it was the whole Jesus scenario. And so anyway, that was dead on. And he sent me this this here video called The Cross, and it was by Billy Graham. And I had no intent. I seen it was 29 minutes long. I says, I am not watching this. I says, I can't be bothered for that. I always go for the minutes before the video. And me and Sarah were arguing. My little brother, who the first time I had ever argued in my life, I argued with him. And I was just like, I'm sick of this. And I ran into the room and I whipped out the phone and I stuck on the video. And he was talking about Jesus and like real powerful men. Now, if you listen to Billy Graham, like he does something to you, he moves. You can listen to him every single repeat, and he does something every single time. And at that point, it was the first time that I'd ever encountered the Holy Spirit. I mean, from head to toe, you're talking goosebumps. You're talking me crying. You're talking about feeling that emotion. I mean, he broke me in my room. I cried and I cried, and I had to turn it off. And so anyway, I messaged Scott, man. I was like, what the heck was that? I says, what was that? I was like, I feel mad. I mean, this feeling is crazy. What was that? He's like, that's Jesus, man. That's Jesus. And I was like, it is Jesus, isn't it? And so I was like, I need to find out more about this fella. And so anyway, Scott was like, right, come up to my house. They had a wee house group going, and he said there was a wee chicken curry going. I was like, I'm going for a wee cheeky chicken curry. To be honest, that was like probably 80% why I went up. So guys, if you're doing outreach, make sure put food in there if you're so anyway, I went up and I remember walking up with Sarah and opened the door, and there's all these headers sitting there, and they're all praying and eating curry, and they're all talking about Jesus. They're talking murderers, talking people who had fought with in the past, drug dealers, all talking about loving this Jesus. I was like, what is going on? I was like, what is this? And so anyway, Scott wasn't going to do any message that day. He wasn't doing any gospel, nothing like that. He didn't have anything planned. And me and Sarah were there, and he was like, I need to get I need to get these two wee fishes. And so we did. We watched this little video. It was about this Robbie Dawkins saving these gangsters, pardon me. Saving these. I thought it was not going to be loud. So anyway, I hate sparkling water, by the way, guys. I was just giving it, because I get nervous and get real dry mouth, but get into the flow. So anyway, Scott just prayed. He was like, Holy Spirit, come. I invite your presence. Just come and touch every heart. All that there stuff. And I started feeling that exact same thing. I felt in the Billy Graham thing. Head to toe. Just goosebumps. You're talking emotions. You're talking about everything in your past just been brought up in a flash. And I started to cry. I was just like, I can't freaking do this, man. I can't do this. And he was just like, no, I want you to make a stand. Anyone in here that feels that, to feel Jesus knocking on your heart, I want you to make a stand. I want you to make a stand for Jesus. If you want to give your life to him, stand up now. And boom, I levitated, and so did Sarah. I'm telling you, like, I didn't even know I was standing. It just happened. And I was just like, dear Lord Jesus, I opened the door of my heart, and every word that I spoke, every single word that I meant it with every inch of my heart. I mean, so me and Sarah gave our life to Jesus. And so did the boxer, the professional boxer that was across the room that me and Scott spoke to first. And me and Sarah ended up going outside, and she was looking at me, and I was looking at her. I was like, what was that? You know, what was that? And I just had this, every burden, every shame, every guilt, everything that I had did on everyone, all the drugs that I had put on people, the jail situation, the people that I hurt, everything, it was just like, that was sticking to me. It all stuck to me my whole life, my past being abused as a kid, everything was just stuck to me. And in that moment, I gave my life to Jesus. It was took away, every bit of it, every inch of guilt, shame, you talk about it, it was gone. And I was just like, I was just jumping about, and I was like, this is class. And we went home, and so me and Sarah went home, and I was like, this is it. I was like, this is the start. This is real. Jesus is real. And you know, it blew my mind and stuff. And I was still on the drugs. Like, I still heavily addicted to drugs. You can talk about any drug I was taking it apart from heroin, because I hated it because my mum was on it and different people in my family were on it, and that was something I really hated. I rebelled against that. And so anyway, first time I ever prayed, I was like, God, if you're real, if you're as real as you say you're real, I was like, take this addiction off me. I was like, just remove it from me. Just, I don't want it anymore. And instantly, the chains of 8 years of addiction was broken, and I was set free from everything, the drugs, the cravings. I didn't even have much of a love for it anymore. But I remember I was going through a couple of days struggle being off them. I think it must have been about 3 or 4 days clean. And I was getting it really tight. I was sweating. I wasn't sleeping. I was crying. I was like, I mean, I'm getting it really bad. But I was off it, do you know what I mean? But it was staying off it was the problem. And I remember walking up Korean. I was walking with Sarah, and I was walking with my mum. And this little still voice in my heart says, go to the tech. And I was just like, okay, I'll go. So I just had that feeling. I never knew it was God speaking to me. I never knew any of that sort of stuff. I didn't even know how to pray, or you know what I mean? I never knew anything. And I walked into the tech and I just said, listen, my name's Ryan Lennon. And I said, I'm finding it very hard. I was like, I need a course to get on. Is there any courses you can help me with? And they're like, no. And this is in the middle, I think this is like January or something. This isn't like in January time. So you're talking like courses start in September. There's nothing like that. And I walked in, they're like, listen, Ryan, it goes to the Prince's Trust, start it a week ago. You won't get on it. You need to be for the induction. I says, I'm getting on that course. I says, give me the number for the woman and let me ring her. And they were like, right, okay, you do it. That's okay. So I rang the girl, called Nicole, ring, ring. I was like, hello, Nicole. I just broke down crying to her. And I just said, listen, I need this. As I'm so struggling here. I was like, I'm battling with drugs. I just gave my life to Jesus. I was like, I really need this course. And she says, listen, Ryan, I'm sorry. You can't come on the course. You can't do the induction. And I was just ready to smash the phone. I was just like, I was just ready to give up. And she goes, what's your second name? I says, Lennon. She goes, you Marty Lennon's big brother? I says, I am. And she was like, you know, I love that wee Marty boy. Hey, he was on my course. He's class and stuff. And she goes, you know what? Come on Monday. And I says, you joking me? And she says, yes. So that was an extra couple of wee days of like focus. It was a wee focus, wasn't it? Like just that wee spark that God kept like putting in, just that wee extra wee inch, that extra wee mile he kept putting it in, just to make sure that I was taking wee different steps towards him. And little, I didn't know it was him at all. I never knew he was setting all this up for me. And I remember going into the tech. We went on this residential. And I was refusing joints left, right, and center. They were bringing ounces, and they were all drinking cider and beer. And I remember being on the phone to Sarah, and she was talking. I was like, "Shut up!" I was like, "Just don't talk to me," because my head was so fried, and the grass was going about, and it was just in the mind. My head was fried, and this is so good. And so I came back from the residential. I was about 8 days, 9 days clean, and God spoke to my mum. God spoke to my mum to speak to Scott. Scott was for Enniskillen. And my mum, I mean, got the bus, I mean, in a mess, walked up to Scott in the town hall and says, you need to take Ryan to Enniskillen. You need to take him. And Scott was like, all right, hold on there, you know, kind of thing. And you know what I mean? Scott's usually like, well, God tells me these things. And so anyway, and then next minute I walked up the town and I was standing there. And I was good frame of mind. I was focused. There was still such I was still homeless at this point. I had no home. And it was me and Sarah was pregnant, bear in mind, and we were living in this little crappy room that was just dreadful. And there was so much arguing going on. There was drugs coming into the house. We were still among it, but inside of us was changed. And so Scott said, listen, Ryan, he goes, I want to take you to a place called Enniskillen. I was like, oh man, are you being serious? And he was like, yeah. And I just felt so special. I just felt so worthy. And he was like, I'm going to take you here on Friday or whatever day it was, on Saturday. And I was like, happy days. We travel. That was an extra focus. I was buzzing about that. And so I remember coming to Enniskillen for the very first time. And I came walking in the little that cafe in the corner, and I met John and instantly took a liking to him because of his Scottish accent and stuff, and he was talking about Celtic and all. I was like, does Christians even support football? And I was like, what? That's like a Celtic man who loves Jesus. I was like, that doesn't even make sense. And so I loved it straight away. I was like, this is cool, man. This is amazing. And then we went on the streets and I seen 21 people give their life to Jesus. And I remember come walking in here in the night service and me and Alex and Darren Kennedy was over in the corner and all these people were coming over and I was so paranoid. And John was like, right, Ryan's going to come up and share. And I was like, oh, no. So I come up and I grabbed the microphone and I remember just staring at that floor. I remember just staring going, yeah, I had a bad life and Jesus came and helped me and now I'm here. And then walked off. And then I just walked off. But I remember going home from Enniskill and I was a new man. I was brand new. I came back stronger. I left and I was telling all the stories. And that's when I declared my love publicly for Jesus, because that sort of thing I really had to watch, you know, with the people that I ran about with and stuff. Like, I was like, I'm going to lose everybody. Is everybody going to think my head's away? I'm going to not speak to the guys that I used to be friends with, all that sort of stuff. And I openly declared my love for Jesus, put it on Facebook, I'm a Christian and I love it type thing. And everyone was just, you know, everyone praised it. It was the complete opposite than what I thought. So I started hitting the streets with Scott. I started seeing people being changed. I started every single day. I was out on the streets with Scott and doing this Jesus at the door thing, just really growing in my faith. And yeah, I was just so hungry for Jesus at that point, just so thirsty for him. I was just like, I need more, I need more, I need more. Because I was so thankful for the life that he brought me from and what I was feeling at that time. But there was something still hanging on, as it always does in your past. Something always creeps up, doesn't it? Doesn't matter how far you're away from it, or it doesn't matter how, you know, much you can forget about it, it'll always creep up. It'll always bite you in the bum and just say, hey, I'm here, you know, type thing. And you probably just have to deal with it. And before I gave my life to Jesus, a couple of weeks before that, I got into a fight in a bar in Antrim. We hammered some crater in the bar, and he called me a fenian or whatever, and it was my uncle's funeral. So he got bottled, and we done him in, and the police came in, and they arrested me. And it was Christmas Eve, and I went to the cells and stuff, and Sarah went to the hospital. The police dog bit Sarah, and that's why I went nuts and stuff and blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, off that was coming up, and I was at court cases and stuff. So this is after Enniskill, and this is when I was doing the street things and stuff. I was going to my church services. I was really digging deep. I was going to the God Squad. I was really loving Jesus, but I was going to court cases at the same time, and I was in breach of 2 suspended sentences. Now, if you know anything about court, you know if you're in breach of 1 suspended sentence, you're for jail. It doesn't matter how much you can try and convince them that your life has changed, you're going to jail. So I was in breach of 2 of them, and I had just finished the Prince's Trust course as well. And I remember talking to my solicitor, and he was like, listen, Ryan, pack your bags. You're going to jail for 6 months. Sarah was pregnant. I would have missed the birth of Matthew. I would have missed it all. And I was like, I'm not going to no jail. I says, no harm. I says, and even if I am, I'm taking it in with me. It doesn't matter if I miss my son's birth, if I miss anything. I says, I'm taking Jesus in the jail, and I'll transform that jail. And so at this point, there was no second chances. I was looking 6 months, and I felt led to ask for references. Now, I asked the Prince's Trust teacher. I was like, listen, Nicole, can you write me a wee reference, please? She was like, course I will. Read this, like, I mean, she gave me it, and I was like, am I really like that? Like, am I that good? And but she was just saying that how I was bringing change to the Prince's Trust, and how I was helping the other guys in it, and I was bringing them to church, and I was bringing them to the group and different things, and that I was a leader, and that all this sort of stuff, and like I was helping blind people, like all this sort of stuff, like people with disabilities. I got full-time employment off the Prince's Trust, so I was really flying, like, at the start. Like, I was only a Christian probably about 3-4 months, I was getting jobs and all this crazy stuff. And so I'd finished the course and stuff, and I remember ringing James. I'd be really friendly with James, and I was like, listen, James, man, I was like, I need a reference, man. And he goes, I'll write you a reference. He goes, because I know this is real for you. So Alan and him got together, and they typed up a reference for me, and it was just short and sweet. Ryan's helping young people from addictions and drugs and different things like that. And So anyway, I went to court with these two references, and that was the only things I had, and the Holy Spirit. So I remember getting in the court, and I rang Sarah, crying my eyes out. I was like, I'm away, my solicitor says I'm going. And didn't I, Sarah? And I was just like, I'm going to jail, I'm sorry. Didn't pack my bag, took faith. I was like, I'm not going to pack my bags, I'm just going to go. They were all just, the judges were talking about like how they're going to hand me my sentence and different things like that. And I had these references, and I was like, God, please give them to the judge, let him read them. So we did, we went in, and he says, listen, whatever. He gave him the two references, and they were like, right, we're going to stop the court case so we can go and read them. And I was like, right, come on, let's do this. I was praying inside my heart for the Holy Spirit to come, just do my best. And so they came back in, and I went back in, and the judge, I was so astounded at the change. He was saying they had never seen anybody change so dramatically in his entire life, and it would be stupid to send me to jail, and all that sort of stuff. And he says, see, if I could walk down there and shake your hand, I would shake your hand. He says, you're the only person that's ever changed, like, that he's ever been in front of. Like, my substantial criminal record with drug busts, crazy amount of drug time or jail time. I spent 3.5 years in prison, all that sort of stuff. He says the dramatic change, he had never seen it in anybody. So they wrote up this big, massive newspaper article about me. I'm sure John and the guys had probably seen it, and they showed it in the church services and stuff. And they let me off, like, they just said, listen, go you away and do probation and stuff like that there. So the Lord opened up that and changed the court case completely. Like, I was for jail. Like, there was no doubt about that. The whole month I was told to pack my bags. My solicitor says, you're going to jail. And the Lord kept me out. So I was thankful for that. I was like, happy days, I'm going to see my son being born and all that sort of stuff. And I made this video for the Vineyard. And yeah, I was a bit worried about it, to be honest, because it was public. We short testimony, and it blew the roof off the place. Hundreds of people came to faith. It went to Berlin, it went to California. And I remember these Californian guys who were just visiting Korean, and they were like, yo, to Scott, they were like, yo, man, do you know the guy Ryan Lennon lives around here and all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, yeah, we seen his video and we really want to meet him and all that sort of stuff. So all these people were coming up to me like saying, you know, are you Ryan? And because my video was took everywhere. And so God was using me in a powerful way, and I didn't even really know it. I was just taking it in. Do you know what I mean? I was just doing my day-to-day thing, focusing on Sarah, focusing on my child coming, all that sort of stuff. But God was really shifting things, and I wasn't even really noticing it. You know what I mean? I was just like, it's happening. You know what I mean? It was quite humble in it. But you know, the devil's in there. He's always going to be in there. It doesn't matter how far you're on, he's always going to be in there. My mum got headbutted in the face, and knocked out two of her teeth. My little brother Marty got jumped in that process of this video, and you know, the Prince's Trust, the court cases, God really moving. But at the same time, the devil was in there doing things to, you know what I mean, to do what he wants. And I remember I had a choice to make, and I did. I rang my boys. I said, listen, I need this boy done. I said, I need him sorted. He hit my ma. I'm getting it done. There were carloads, hurling sticks. There was friggin' tables. There was, you're talking, everything was going to be done. This boy was going to be killed. And I remember I had a choice to listen to the old me or to listen to the new me. And it was very, 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 very hard. And I remember Sarah coming in, and this pastor, we were staying in this pastor's house for 5 months. And he came in. And he was like, I break off the spirit of us. And he just, real prophetic, and he knew what was going on. And I had a choice to make. Did I pray for this fella, or did I go and send my lads to him? And I did. I prayed for him. I took the good choice. The next day he got saved. So the next day he got saved. Up the town, gave his life to Jesus. And I was just like, thank you, God. Because, yeah, I was going to kill him. Not me. I didn't have to do anything. I just made the phone calls and it would have done. So just after that, I started reading the Bible, started falling in love with Jesus a bit more and all that sort of stuff. And it really made me think of the lost people, the souls that needed to be reached, because I was one of them, wasn't I? I was one of the guys who was running about lost, doing the drugs and doing the women and, you know, being in jail as a lost soul. So my heart started breaking for people like that. I started really finding it, hard to not see someone walk by and not say, "Listen, man, Jesus is here. Jesus is the hope that you need." And a lot of people didn't listen. A lot of people kind of like was like, it's not my thing." But I was living proof of that. I was living proof of that. That God saved me from the mess that I was in. Like, I mean, I went through a crap time. Like, I mean, my life was so bad, but God saved me and showed me that my past isn't just wiped, but it's going to be used for the future. So that was dead on. My heart was breaking for my brother Mark. My brother Mark was really a real crazy psychotic person. And I prayed for him, and he used to shout up the town. He goes, "You're being used by the Vineyard. You're all a bunch of scumbags." He goes, "Scott McNamara's a baldy," all this stuff. And I was like, "Mark, you don't know him. You don't know him." I was like, "You don't know." And he's like, "Evolution." And he was like, "The devil's my God." And he gave it to me as hard as you can get. And I remember crying to Sarah all the time about it, like just hurt that Mark's is in that mess and I'm standing the way I am. I was like, why do I deserve this? Why is he not where I am? You know what I mean? I was like, why can I not give it to him? I was just scared of him burning in hell. Like, that's the truth behind it. I kept thinking that. Just him screaming and stuff, and it done my head in. And so I just had to keep going, had to keep focused, keep motivated, just keep trusting in God, handing it all to him. I just keep, just everything that came to me, it was just like, "God, take that. I can't handle it. I don't want it. I don't want it. I don't want it." I didn't want any of it. My mum and stuff. And, I've been blessed massively by God and Jesus and the church and the vineyards and the guys here and stuff, and just meeting new friends. I'm able to travel to different churches, training church leaders and training different churches on the tool we use, Jesus at the Door. I'm sorry I couldn't get, I was supposed to come here one time, but I can't remember what I was doing. I think I might have started a new job. And we pioneer the tool, evangelism, and I'd be invited like to different churches to share my testimony and different things like that. This is actually the first time in a service or anything that I've ever shared my testimony properly. So I am a bit nervous. I was nervous at the start, but I feel okay, because I love these guys. So I've been in probation as well. Asked me to share my testimony. They put up on their website about my change, like probation. Like, I was just like, "Yeah, I'll do it." Type thing. I was just like, "Listen, I'll do it." I didn't really have much respect for them, but I said, "Listen, I'll do it, man. If it changes a life, I'll do it." So probation started doing me articles about me. The newspaper started doing articles about me. And I remember the police officer. He used to bust my house. Like, our house used to get bust like every couple of months. And there was one time they found 14.5 grand's worth of drugs, and I went away for a long time because of that. And he was laughing at me. He was like, "I got you now, Lennon. I got you now, finally." And I was like, "Oh, I'm gonna kill you." But anyway, I was sitting in the sauna one time, and I looked to my right, and there was this bald guy, and I was like, "Why is he looking at me like that? Why is he looking at me so funny?" And this is not that long, it was about 6 months ago, and I'd realized it was him. The police officer who used to arrest me, he used to do crazy things, pepper spray me, all that stuff. And he says, "Ryan," he goes, "I have an apology to make." I was like, "Why?" I was like, "What are you on about?" I was just so nervous. I don't know what they really take it. I was thinking he's going to think I'm going to hit him. That's what I thought. Like, in my head, I was like, he thinks I'm going to do him in. And he goes, "I have an apology to make." And I was just like, "Oh, no." And he goes, "Your video was going through the PSNI. And he goes, "All the officers were watching it, going, look at Ryan Lennon now, look at the change, all that sort of stuff." And they were all talking about it. And he says, "You know, I was one of the ones said that you're full of sh crap." That's what he said. He said a different word. He says, "I was one of the ones that said you were full of crap." And he put out his hand and he shook my hand. He says, "You proved me wrong, Ryan. You've proved me wrong." I was buzzing about that. I was like, "Yeah." I was humble in the moment. But when he left, I was like, "Get in there, Lennon. Get in there, son." I'd beat them. Jesus did. And at the end of the day, it does say in the Bible that even God will make your enemies at peace with you. And then, boys, were my enemies. I had a lot of enemies. And So I've seen hundreds of people come to Jesus. I've had the privilege to lead lots of people to Jesus. We have a group. I lead a group. Me and my wife lead a group called the New Believers. We go on the streets. We preach to Jesus at the door. We get these new believers, and we have a place for them to come every single Thursday at 7:30. We worship Jesus. We invite the Holy Spirit. We just do all the good stuff, all the good stuff, and just living the dream type thing. You know what I mean? So off the back of that, I got some people got in touch with me, and just before Sarah comes up and shares her wee bits and pieces, I got a phone call from this. I didn't even know this was happening. I get nominated for an award, and so when I got this phone call from this English boy, and he was like, "Ryan," he goes, "you might already know that I'm coming over to make a movie of your story." I was like, "What?" I was like, "I don't even know that." I says, "What's it about?" And he goes, "I'm a film producer. I do the army adverts, blah, blah, blah." He goes, "I want to come over and make a film of you." I was like, "Mate, no bother." I says, "Of course." I says, "You can do that." I says, "Let's have a bit of fun." And I was like, "What is it for?" And I got nominated for Pride of Britain. Which is like this big crazy friggin' meeting Tom Hardy and Will I Am, all this crazy stuff. And I was like, "Are you being serious?" I got nominated through the Prince's Trust for the Rising Star Award. And I was just like, "What?" I was like, "Rising Star?" I was like, "What's that even mean?" And they were like, "Someone who came from the dirt and the gutter and they got out of it and now they're a star," type thing. And so I was just like, I started reading up on this Pride of Britain thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's a big deal. Like, you're talking TV, ITV, friggin' live, all that sort of stuff. They may watch me on live TV, I'm telling you. I'll be hitting the Jesus at the door. I'll be praying for Tom Hardy. I'll be doing all that stuff. You only get one shot at that sort of stuff, you know what I mean? And I'll be remembered for that. So yeah, just Pride of Britain type stuff. And my brother Mark, I just realized is something that, like, really, I know a few of you have heard, but my brother Mark came to our meeting there the Thursday past. And he's splitting up with his woman. He's going through a real hard time. He rang me. He was going to commit suicide, and I phone called him. And I wasn't easy on him. I seen you wind your neck in. I'm your brother. Blah blah blah. Just give it to him. Solid. You know what I mean? Wise up. You know what I mean, Mark? Wise up. And he said, "Listen, the strength that you gave me that day." He goes, "He necked a pint," and he said, "If you weren't answering that phone call," he says, "I was gone." And so I answered the phone call, and we spoke to each other, blah, blah, blah. And I wish I could show the video. And so anyway, I said, "Listen, Mark, you need to come to this God Squad with me tonight." And he was like, "Listen, man, I'm not interested. Stop being stupid. You've tried. You've hassled me. You're doing my head in." And I'm like, "I don't care. You're coming." And he was like, and then next minute, I was just like, I was raging that he wasn't going to come. I was like, this is his night. Because when you're in that broken heart frame, I mean, you're in that kind of like, you know, ick, it's the perfect place to get, you know, Jesus introduced. And so when I went, Mark was like, "I tell you what," he goes, "if you give me a lift to go get my script, I'll go to the God Squad." I was like, "It's only for an hour, but you're just about 2 hours and a half." So I didn't want to say to him that it was 2 hours and a half. I was like, "It's only an hour, Mark, out of your life, and just tea and all that sort of stuff." Just trying to coach him in. I kind of lied, but listen, it's all right. God forgive me. just to get him in. It was one shot for him. And it was something that I've been praying on for so long. And so anyway, that was dead on. He came and just something like that. And I was furious. I mean, you're talking like rage and anger. So I was even getting annoyed at Scott. I was like, "You're not even preaching the right thing." And I was ringing Jay, and I was like, "Jay, you need these." I was saying, "You need this song. You need this song." Ringing Scott saying, "You need to say these words." Like, I was so desperate for his soul. So, so desperate. And I remember he said he was coming, and I made a video of me jumping about my work, sent it to Sarah. I was like, "He's coming," and all that sort of stuff. And then when we went there, I was like, "We're all doing it wrong." I says, "You're all freaking doing it wrong." I was like, "Scott, why are you speaking so low?" And I was like, "Don't read that." And like, not in myself, I wasn't actually saying this, but I mean, inside, I was raging. I was that rage, I couldn't even put my hands up in worship or anything. I was just so worried that Mark was hating it. And so anyway, he started interrupting Scott, going, "You know, I've tried this for so long." He goes, "It doesn't even work in me." He goes, "If this works in me," he put a lot of pressure on me. He says, "If this doesn't work tonight, I'll never be back in that church again. Don't ask me for it again." So that was a lot of pressure on me. And I was just like, and then I rang Scott and Scott said, "You need to leave it with the Holy Spirit. You need to leave it with Jesus." And I was like, "Right, I'll do." And I, to be honest, I wanted to take control of it myself because I was so scared that he wouldn't. I was so scared that this was the chance. This was the only chance that I got for my brother's life. And I mean, for you're talking like about a year of visions of him burning in hell, visions of him dying, me losing him, me being too late, having dreams about him taking cocaine and overdosing. You talk about the fear of his life, I had it. And so the Holy Spirit does what he does. And Scott started speaking low, and at this point I was just like, "You know, you're doing it crap." I was like, "You're not doing it right." So anyway, listen, this is only like a couple of days ago. And next minute, we started praying for Mark. And it was like, nothing was happening. Nothing was happening during worship. None of that sort of stuff was happening. So we started praying for him. It was only me praying for him. I was like, "Scott, go over here. Don't leave me. Like, I need someone here. Like, I need it." Because it's a personal thing with your family, isn't it? You get that personal barrier. But I was just like, speaking in tongues over him. And I think he was thinking it was weird. And I was just praying for him. I was like, "Just connect, Mark." I was like, "Just break the barrier down." Then Scott came over and just started praying for him. And the next minute, he just started to shake. And he started to shake. And he was like, "Don't stop. It's helping. Don't stop. Don't stop." And I was just like, yes. And then next minute, he was like, "Don't stop." Next, he started manifesting and demons started leaving his body. He fell to the floor and he started shaking and he was crying and he tried to run away and he ran clean into my arms and I just grabbed him and we was just like crying. I mean, you talk about crying. I was weeping and he was like, "I'm so sorry, God. I'm so sorry, God." And he gave his life to Jesus on the spot. So he did. And that was like, I'm telling you, that is the biggest story that I can ever say what God's done in my life has saved my brother. You could do the Pride of Britain, you could do all that sort of biz. That's all for the other stuff, like, you know what I mean? But I mean for my brother's soul and my family's soul and for their lives, that meant the world to me. And yeah, just share quickly of me being in prison and there on Saturday. Was it Saturday? Thursday, I'm really crap. The day Saturday. Not Sunday. That's how terrible I am. As you know, I'm 3 years out of prison. I spent 3.5 years in prison. We met with this governor a couple of weeks ago, me and Scott. And we prayed for her and she cried and she was just so grateful to see someone like me change my life. And she was like, "You know why? My heart breaks for guys like you to change their lives and stuff." And I got granted all access to McGilligan Prison. Now, that's something that's unheard of. That's history being made. Like, no one, any ex-prisoner you're talking has never stepped in foot of any prison. You're talking 10 years clean. You have to be, your record has to be swiped clear. You need references. You need it all. I didn't need any of it. I needed Jesus. And he got me in. And we went in and seen all the old lads. They were like, "What are you in for, Lennon? What are you in for?" And I was like, "Mate, I'm in to do a concert to show you Jesus." And we led a couple of Jesus. And we led an SO, a senior officer, the Jesus, and all that crazy stuff. So listen, I'm going to pass it on to Sarah. But I just want to say that, you know, I've never had a family. I never grew up to a family. I've never had a job, anything like that. So I just want to say that, you know, Jesus does save. And he rescued me and Sarah from a lot of stuff.